Helen in Mount Burnett. Good morning, Helen.
Hi. I've just had an exciting morning. I lit some weeds on my green bit of grass out the back here.
Yes.
And within no time at all, there's a helicopter going around and around and around and around. I thought, heavens, he's going to land in a minute. And he was obviously getting his shirt in a knot. And I thought, oh, maybe it's a restriction day or something, and no. I haven't heard about it.
Sorry, you lit a fire on your property and then they came and checked it out in a helicopter.
Well, the helicopter's going over and over and, yeah, round and round and
that
round.
Sounds like a terrific piece of news, Helen. I'm delighted that they're, in fact, vigilant and careful.
So anyway, I thought, oh, well, I'd better ring the post office and find out if I'm lighting a fire on a restriction day.
Yeah, Helen, can I ask, was this your own property that you were setting this fire on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, just checking.
Right.
Helen, I'm reassured by hearing
your
story.
Well, then I rang the post office and they said, oh, I don't know. And they usually have a big sign up if it's a fire restriction day.
Yeah, it's on the newspapers,
so
it's on the radio.
Right, can't be. So then I thought, oh, I'd just better ring ABC and check.
Yeah.
So I rang ABC and the girl said, no.
No, so, well, I'm reassured, Helen, that even if there's a little fire, they're coming and making sure that it's nothing untoward. That's very reassuring news. Thank you for calling in on the open line.
The Conversation Hour with John Fain. On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
It's 11:05. Welcome to today's Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, the World Wide Web at abc.net.au/Melbourne, and on digital radio as well, where you just turn on the radio and magically up it pops. Goodness gracious, look at that. How do they do it? I'm John Fain, Tony Martin, comedian, author, and exhausted subject of author tour interviews is my co-host today before Ray Martin, not related, will be joining us to talk about his glittering career in commercial TV and before that with the ABC, a much forgotten part of his journalistic career. Tony Martin, good morning.
Good morning, John. I am exhausted. I've done 62 interviews. I'm sick of hearing about myself, frankly. It's interesting just sitting in a booth saying the same thing over and over to like 9 different parts of Australia in the one day, and you get to the point where you go, did I say this earlier in this interview or in the one before? But I had an interesting one. I did a breakfast show in Brisbane.
We should explain, you're promoting your new book.
It's called A Nest of Occasionals, for reasons we don't have time to explain.
Nicely got in.
But
have you already explained what it is in this interview, or was that in an earlier one?
Okay, where am I again? You're still John Fain. But it was, I did one in Brisbane where the interviewer just got incredibly aggressive during the interview.
And
it was a guy called Ash, and because I know Michelle Laurie, I do that show ADBC with her, and she does a breakfast show on Nova with this guy Ash, and he was like
Nova Brisbane.
And there's this thing where, you know, on radio interviews you don't have time to read every book. Do you read all the books that you sent, John, if you have people coming in?
I can't read every book from cover to cover,
but
I reckon I put about an hour into any book we're going to do, because I think it's an insult not to prepare. The guest's gone to the trouble of writing it.
Sure.
The least I can do is put in some time to have have a conversation where at least I know what is in the book.
But the thing is, you don't have time to read all of them. So what you do is you either say, look, I haven't had time to read it, or you say, I've read some of it.
Yeah.
But this guy's like, his opening question was, what's the name of your book again? He didn't even know what the name was. And then he got really sort of aggro during the interview and was like asking me about the Mick Malloy business. And he's going, mate, I don't want to hear funny answers. Give me the serious answer. And he was getting quite aggressive, and I'm making a few jokes about it. And he's like, oh, okay, so you come on my show and you're not going to answer any questions. Fine. And then he just wasn't talking for the rest of the interview. It was like really quite uncomfortable. Then about
face to face?
No, this is down the line. So
you're in a studio
in Melbourne
and he's in Brisbane.
That's right. And then about 3 days after that, somebody sent me an article from the Courier Mail that said that this gentleman, Ash, had voluntarily stood down from his role on the Nova Breakfast program after admitting that he has a problem with alcohol. And I was thinking back.
I'm getting a thing on the screen here. Sally, who used to work in commercial radio, says Ash just got busted for drink driving, now is in rehab. So.
And there was a figure quoted in the paper. It was the largest figure I've ever seen in connection with blood alcohol levels. I'm going, surely there's an extra zero being added onto that. But it made perfect...
At the front, not the back, yeah.
But it made perfect sense when I went back to the interview, because it had that... You know when you're in a pub and somebody is slightly... over the limit, and they won't let go, and they're just great. Well, no, mate, what's the real story with that? No, come on, mate.
Don't bullshit. Really?
That's right. No. So that was the worst one that I did, but there was it's generally been quite good, actually.
And on average, what proportion of people who are interviewing you have got some familiarity with the subject matter? Have made an effort to go beyond the back cover or some cheat sheets produced by the producer?
Well, when you get a good one like James O'Loughlin, like he really knew. And I was surprised David Rain, who I wouldn't have thought would have been a massive reader, knew everything about the book. And it makes for a much better interview.
Where's he on air now?
He's on David and Kim in the morning. You don't know what that is, do you?
What's David and Kim in the morning?
I wasn't sure. I think I might have called him Koshy halfway through the actual interview. But it's good when people do it. I mentioned,
is that a TV show?
That is a TV show, John.
Okay, right, thank you.
You're doing your program when it's on. You'd have no idea.
You've never seen Kerry Ann, have you? I'm in my own little bubble and world, and I know there's other stuff around, but I mean, there's that much I have to do. I know the people who have been around for ages, but David Rain, wasn't he the one who was on ABC Radio in Sydney?
David Rain, this is James Rain's brother.
And he was on ABC Radio in Sydney, and he'd been there for about 5 minutes, and then got offered a gig on Breakfast TV.
Is that right?
And took it and quit.
And that because I only know him as being one of the four men who were in the Shantousies. Remember the Shantousies with Donnie Goldsmith? People forget they had an earlier incarnation where it was four women and four men.
Well, hang on. Maybe I'm confusing one of the Rains with one of the Daddos.
You're right. It's easily done. It's easily done.
Interchangeable parts.
There's a lot of them.
Oh, no, look, I don't know. Look, I struggle to keep up. And the other thing is, there's so many commercial radio stations around,
especially the
FM ones, and they change suits so often.
That's right.
You kind of just get used to who's there, and then they're all gone, and there's a whole other bunch, and you're going, who are they?
People are constantly leaving to spend more time with their families or go travelling.
Or go on special projects.
Special projects. There was a bloke on a local station in Melbourne, I won't say who just got back from like a four-month round-the-world tour. And he was told that he was sacked. And they do that thing where we're not going to... Nobody is ever sacked from radio now.
I've been sacked.
If you know. But it's always... You won't get your payout unless you agree to sign this press release that says that it's your idea.
That's right.
And this bloke was forced to sign one saying that he wanted to spend more time travelling, even though, as his listeners were aware, he'd just been travelling for 4 months. So that goes on. It's fun to... I decided not to go with that. I decided, when we were sacked, I decided to just say, no, we've been sacked.
Yeah, so you refused to sign? Or you didn't take the extra money for agreeing not to have pretended to be sacked?
Well, we just got in first because I thought, you know, our listeners, the thing about the show I was doing is it was a show where we just told them everything that was going on.
Mm.
You know, any trouble that was going on with management was part of the show. So it would have just rung false if I'd wheeled out the I'd like to spend more time with my family. And as listeners would have known about my family, they wouldn't have bought it.
Yeah.
That I would want to spend more time with my family.
In fact, quite the reverse. I'm shattered. Right. I now have to spend more time with my shambly family, which is very, very disappointing and going to prove to be difficult for everybody involved.
That's right. But they produced one of these press releases. They wanted me to sign it. And I said, no, I'm just going to come on Monday and say that we've been sacked. And there was a massive panic to put out a press release to sort of somehow incorporate what I was going to say with what they wanted to be said. And in the end, they put out two separate press releases that posited two completely contradictory reasons as to why we were leaving.
You couldn't script it better, could
you? No.
But so you were being managed.
That's right,
yeah, managed. You were being managed.
Well, I've done this thing on the radio. Gary Sizzle is this thing that a lot of people are looking up on YouTube. It was mentioned in the Green Guide the other day, which is a sketch I did on Triple R, where I went in during Radiothon week and pretended to be a consultant from commercial radio.
Telling them how to fix things up there.
That's right, how to, you know, give it a bit more traction and cut through.
Yeah.
And of the 62 interviews I did to promote the book, you know, you're on the phone and you're waiting to go on, so a song's finishing, and so the announcer will come on and go, oh, mate, I heard that Gary Sizzle thing that's going around. I've got one for you. And so I've just accumulated so many stories now.
So Gary has got a whole new repertoire.
Well, there was one guy who told me that he was interviewing Henry Winkler on air. And
The Fonz,
but this is only a couple of years ago. So Henry Winkler, I think, is in his 60s now, and he was promoting that Arrested Development on TV. And he was telling quite a funny but quite a long anecdote. And one of the program director, who is one of the guys who Gary Sizzle is based on, appeared in the glass behind Winkler, so Winkler couldn't see him, and the announcer just giving him the wind-up motion. And, of course, it was a long story, so he couldn't do it. So after the interview, the program director just came on and go, mate, you should have wound up that interview sooner. And the announcer's gone, well, what could I have said to Henry Winkler? He's gone, mate, here's what you say. You say, that's all well and good, Fonzie, but we're out of time.
Well, you just interrupt him.
That's right, just call him Fonzie at the age of 62. So there's just endless stories like
that. But that's that classic thing from management, which you can occasionally get anywhere, including here at the ABC, where sure. they're not listening to the content, they're listening to the style.
That's right.
And they've got a template, and it's got to fit into the template.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you're saying, but any, for instance, any talkback caller that goes for more than 90 seconds,
too long.
They could be telling you about the death of their child last week in a traumatic accident. No callers more than 90 seconds. You can get, too many old callers. I want more younger callers. You say, hang on, but if some person, regardless of their age, rings up and makes a good point, what does it matter whether they're 40 or 70?
Right.
And so on. No, we don't want the mix. We want to change the mix. And we have these arguments all the time, even here.
But here you, what I know, because I do mainly here and Triple R, and what they have in common is there's a certain assumption that the audience has at least a certain amount of intelligence.
Of course they are.
Of course they are. You're using long words in here. I've heard them. You just said management before. It's got three syllables. But there's in commercial radio, you're constantly told to... It's never actually... The phrase dumb down is never used, but it's constantly implied. Don't say... well, the example I always use is when the people were pitching the film Being John Malkovich.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever they took it, they would get studio heads going, but why don't you make it Being Tom Cruise? Because more people have heard of Tom Cruise. But Being Tom Cruise is not funny for some reason. There's just something funny. You can't explain why Being John Malkovich is funnier than Being Tom Cruise. But that sort of attitude is what you constantly get in commercial radio. And it's always assumed that the program director is always usually a fairly dumb guy, usually an ex-announcer, not very smart, who assumes that his ignorance is somehow emblematic and representative of the listeners who you're talking to. So he'll constantly say, mate, if I haven't heard of it, they haven't heard of it.
Mm.
So you constantly get that. One station I went in on recently, the host said to me that he was talking to callers on Christmas Eve, or just after Christmas Eve, and they were describing what they'd done on Christmas Eve. And this woman had gone, oh, we had a terrible Christmas Eve. Somebody rented a German submarine movie, and we had to sit through that. And the host has gone, oh, was it Das Boot? And the woman's gone, that's it, Das Boot. And then after the show, the announcer was hauled into the program director's office and said, mate, I was driving into work this morning and you referred to a German submarine movie and I hadn't heard of it and I felt stupid. And that's you constantly, you're going, could it be possibly because you are stupid? Could that be the reason?
But by the way, here's my letter announcing that I'm quitting. That can be the consequence of those sort of comments. Accents, though, you're quite right. People say, oh, look, too many people with accents.
Really? Do you get that?
Oh, sometimes.
God.
I get cranky about that one.
Accents.
Yeah, I get cranky about that because in reality, in the community...
Mm. There are quite a few accents if you get out there.
In listener land, people have accents.
I didn't notice that because often you mentioned off-air Alan Brough, who's here on the ABC, and he still has a New Zealand accent.
Yes.
Mine's sort of half New Zealand, half Australian. It's weird.
Yours is barely recognisably. Occasionally it sneaks out.
Well, I remember on the last show I did, we just by fluke, we had an hour of the show where it was me, Alan Brough and Cal Wilson were all on at the same time. And I'd never experienced racism directed at New Zealanders before. There was people calling up going, bloody New Zealand, you've got to be a bloody New Zealander to be on this station now, dear. And it was, I'd never...
Just say, yep, basically.
That's right. Correct.
If you don't like it.
I'd never experienced that kind of hatred of New Zealanders before. Usually it's quite...
A persecuted minority. You can always get on a boat and sail home and see if they'll offer you refugee status.
New Zealanders, the forgotten wogs, that's what I always say.
Tony Martin, my co-host, and the book is called A Nest of Occasionals.
Yes.
And you'll find that in bookshops in time for Christmas. Oh, goodness gracious. And I've got a text message for you here. Tony, finished your book on the weekend. Fantastic read. I'm going to Te Kuiti next week.
Te Kuiti.
Te Kuiti. Thank you for correcting me.
That's Maori for the Kuiti.
Uh-huh.
In New Zealand, just about an hour south of Hamilton, if you're going there.
Right.
The sheep-shearing capital, not just of New Zealand, of the world, John.
And don't let anybody forget it.
That's right, giant statue to prove it. I got an email this morning from my publisher who said she was in Brisbane
mm-hmm.
at Coldrake's, which is quite a respected bookshop, and she found three copies of my book in the queer non-fiction section. So apparently, by Queensland standards, I'm pretty gay, apparently.
Do you go around bookshops and take them from the back of the shelf and put them to the front and turn them around so it's not the spine showing but the face of the book showing?
Of course I do. Everybody does that. Here's what I do. I'm a scourge at Borders. I'll often just get the McGattos, the two pile of McGattos, and put them to one pile and then sneak over to Humour and just two or three copies at a time start making a new pile of my book.
Rearrange the shelves. Do you autograph a few while you're there?
No, that's interesting. You know, once you've signed them, the bookshop can't send them back.
Oh.
Yeah. So Bryce Courtney, apparently, he will sign every last copy of the shop. So a few years ago when my first book came out, I went to this bookshop and they've gone, oh, can you sign some for us? And they've brought over 5 books and I've started signing them. And then I've noticed they've got about 15 more and I've gone, I'll do those as well. And they've gone, no, this is probably enough.
Just in case.
That's fine.
Tony Martin, my co-host. Joining us in a moment, Ray Martin.
Yes, no relation.
No relation. You probably thought you knew a lot about Ray Martin, but until I read the autobiography that he's just put out called Stories of My Life, I realised that there's many more dimensions to the man who has graced our TV screens for as long as I can remember. He undoubtedly has a distinguished career as a journalist, but his work as a philanthropist, his work for various charities and causes, and his work behind the scenes on a whole lot of other projects was quite news to me. I'd also, I cheerfully admit, quite forgotten his distinguished career before 60 Minutes as an ABC foreign correspondent, and some of the stories he tells throughout his distinguished career make for fascinating reading, and I'm sure he'll be a wonderful storyteller when he joins us in just a moment here on the Conversation Hour as well. It's 20 past 11 on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, the World Wide Web and digital radio as well. That's Madonna, Ray of Light, to introduce Ray Martin. Oh, aren't we clever to the Conversation Hour? That's from 1998 from the album Ray of Light. There's not many things with Ray in the title, but Ray Martin's new book does. Stories of My Life, the autobiography, is titled really just Ray. And Ray Martin is our guest with Tony Martin, my co-host on the Conversation Hour today. Welcome.
Thanks, John.
Back
Thanks,
to an ABC studio, in fact.
Ray it Martin. Is nice. In fact, I did something a month or so back. I did a story for 7:30 Report on about Palm Island, the Aboriginal gulag, and that was the first time I'd been on the ABC television for current affairs for 30 years, and my cameraman was an ex-ABC man in London. He hadn't done it for 25 years, so combined 55 years since we'd sort of stepped in the studio. It was good fun.
And you speak with great affection about your years at the ABC, and I was quite thinking, well, Ray Martin's such a commercial television creature, but it's almost tinged with regret the good times you had looking back at them now, including perhaps a regret at not taking up the position as the head of ABC Sport, which was offered to you to try and stop you going to 60 Minutes.
Yeah, no, I never regretted that. The idea of driving a desk somewhere. But at one stage when I was in New York, I was appointed. It was going to be 3 years, and then it became 6, and then it became 9. And the last time that Talbot Duckmadden appointed me, he actually said, we're quite happy, I'm quite happy for you to stay here forever, was the word. In New York, I was, you know, no children, and my wife and I had been married just before we went there. And the idea of staying in the Middle Kingdom for the rest of my life was fantastic. Except he said, but if you decide to stay, then I don't want you to get upset about not being promoted up the executive ladder of the ABC. And I said, I promise I won't.
But the thought, the thought never crossed your mind?
To go to executive side of?
Yeah,
no.
Even in commercial television?
No.
Because being on the receiving end of the instructions from people, as Tony Martin was saying a moment ago, that you may not have the highest regard for, can be incredibly frustrating.
But the difference is, I found on commercial television too, and I think it's the same in the ABC, is that the people who make the decisions, the carpet strollers as I call them, really want to do what we do. They want to do what you do. They want the satisfaction of getting out and smelling the roses or talking to interesting people, as against making those decisions that have to be made. And good executives are worth bottling, and we should bottle them.
But here, like at the ABC, you will have fairly intelligent executives who might have been to...
To a person. Every single one of them. Brilliant.
If Mark Scott is listening, absolutely.
Generous.
Whereas in sort of commercial FM radio, where I'm from, I think Kyle Sanderlands, of all people, actually won a lot of admirers, in fact, in the business when he finally came out and said something that nobody else has had the ego or the guts to say, which is, in commercial FM radio, it's the only job where your boss is someone who has failed at what you were doing. They're usually failed. They generally are failed announcers.
Well, and I couldn't believe when I went to the commercial after 13 years in the ABC, Sam Chisholm was my boss, and obviously Kerry Packer was above it. A, I couldn't understand how Kerry Packer is the richest man in Australia. Really did have a finger on the pulse. He was able to say what he thought Australian commercial viewers didn't want to see. And he often did tell us. And I used to say, how would you know? And he'd say, listen, son, I just know.
And how did he?
I don't know. It obviously is an instinct. It obviously is. One thing I'm thinking particularly, we did an early 60-minute stage, did a couple of stories about the lot of prisoners in jails around Australia. And I can't use the language, but he told us fairly quickly how Australians didn't give a rat's about people who were, basically dying in prison. And let's move on and do something they care about. They don't care about, and simply politicians.
But he also argued with you about guns at a conversation around the dinner table that you recount in some detail with Peter Costello and others sitting around the dinner table.
I did indeed. He was at that stage. We thought Peter Costello was going to be the Prime Minister, and I'm sure Peter thought he was going to be. And so he was sitting.
Suddenly, recently dawned on him that he won't be.
Probably about 10 people around the table at the mansion in Bellevue Hill, and so he asked, as a result of Port Arthur, John Howard had changed the gun laws, and he asked Peter Costello, the next Prime Minister, what he thought of Howard's gun laws. And Costello said, well, he was hedging a bit and said, well, it had to be done because of the tragedy of Port Arthur. And so Packer told him exactly what he thought of him and told him he was a so-and-so idiot. And then he said to me, what do you think? And I said, well, I think they should have been tougher. I think they should have put a ban on handguns. And he quickly told me what I was and moved around the table. I forget what Laurie Oakes said.
He quickly produced a gun. Dear, oh dear.
Not on this occasion. What sort of a man was he, apart from his instinct for TV? You had a lot of dealings with him over the years, and you tell some stories.
Well, I think he was a one-off. Not just because he was, it's sort of like he should have been born in Queensland, I think, physically and otherwise, but a great visceral sense of things. I mean, he was a bit like John Singleton in terms of didn't beat around the bush, cut to the quick, very quickly, straight away on issues. Obviously, was believed, and I also say in there he used to say, basically, we got his opinion on everything. So I think he was used to getting his own way, but he also quite liked an argument. To a degree.
He respected you if you argued by the sound of it too.
To the degree, but then you'd suddenly find you were sacked.
And Channel 9 post Kerry Packer, you reflect, as have many others, on what's gone wrong in the Ray Martin version of what's happened.
Yeah, well, I think that, let's forget my version, just the facts. The facts are, once David Leckie was sacked by Packer, by a sick man, at that stage he was ailing, in 2002, we then had 7 CEOs in the space of 5 years. Five different bosses of news and current affairs is one of the pillars of the Nine network. To lose 5 bosses there, to lose the bosses of sport, commercials, publicity, drama, da da da. Say that to an executive of any persuasion, and they'd say, well, how come Channel 9's still alive today? It's amazing that it exists. Now, that had to be decisions that were made by Packer and the board to get rid of 7 CEOs.
And Eddie Maguire as a boss?
Eddie Maguire was probably the Peter principle. I think that it went one step too far. I think Eddie on camera and on microphone is a fantastic talent. That doesn't automatically mean you're going to be a good manager. And I think he wasn't helped, given the fact that they were trying to cut things back, everything back at that stage. But I think basically, we should, including Ray Martin, we should stick to what we can do best.
But also, Hey Hey Saturday, I was never a huge fan of Hey Hey Saturday. But when they took that show off, it was like the station lost its homepage. It lost some sort of personality.
I think that's the start of it. I think when they took Midday off with Kerry-Anne at that stage, and when they took Hey Hey off the next year, that was the start of the crumble. That was the start of television viewers, I think, certainly commercial viewers, and I think ABC viewers, they like old slippers, they like old favourites, they don't like people leaving home. And when programmes finish, like the Midday Show, which had been the Mike Walsh show and then had been the Midday Show for 25 years, just to basically chuck out your favourite aunt without saying goodbye, without giving a suitcase, which is what they did, to get rid of Hey Hey. If they thought Daryl, for example, was too long in the tooth for that, then Rove was around. Rove could have, they owned the format. I think that was one of those shows that the demographic was from 6 to 96 that people used to watch that show, and I think that becomes part of the furniture and part of the shape, the parameters of Channel 9, and they lost both.
Where do you line up on this argument that television's in this kind of terminal tailspin, its gradual decline, inevitable and complete decline? Do you subscribe to that theory?
Yeah, probably. I don't think it has to be as fast as it's going now. I don't think, you know, ABC has shown in the last couple of years, and I said this at the Andrew Ollie lecture last year, that the if you look at programs like the ratings for 7 o'clock news, 7.30 with Kerry O'Brien, and then Q&A. Q&A does better in Sydney and Brisbane than the footy show. Q&A, even Four Corners getting the best figures they've ever had, is a fair sign that Australians want some content. It's a fair sign that people out there actually want to be told something. And I don't know how difficult it is for commercial television to realise that, in fact, they went back to, apart from 60 Minutes and some of the interviews on a Sunday morning, otherwise there's just nothing, no meat and potatoes there. And I think...
Different. They won't take a risk. They're such a, you know, risk-averse bunch of people now in charge of, in particular,
absolutely,
commercial TV.
Absolutely. You know, worse than banks, more conservative than banks.
How do you change that? You've seen it up close.
Well, the difference, of, you know, people like Sam Chisholm, who was the best boss I ever had in those sort of golden days of Channel 9, he would simply employ people to do a job like you're doing, and when you don't, when you stuff up or when your ratings don't work, he'd sack you and get someone else. So was that he wouldn't try to interfere, whereas I think nowadays executives tend to think that they know, you know, what Australians want.
Micromanage it.
And they do micromanage it. And so the end result, you get things like dance your fat ass off. Now, who in Australia ever thought that that was going to work? And yet someone through programming said, well, let's put this on because Australians want to see fat people wobble their fat. And they don't.
What do you watch?
I watch many of the programs I've just mentioned.
Dance Your Art.
No, we're talking about 7.30 Report, et cetera, et cetera. I watch The Chaser, and I watch programs. If I wasn't talking on the ABC, I'd still say this. I watch 60 Minutes, I watch a lot of sport, and I watch a lot of news on pay television.
Any of the light entertainment?
I love the, if we're talking about satire, I love the Colbert Show, and I love the Daily Show on, you know, on...
Along with so many other practitioners in the media.
For so long we've said Americans have no sense of irony. Well, those programs are so ironic.
They're amazing, those shows. So Jon Stewart, recently there's been this huge debate about Fox News and the Obama administration refusing to engage with them, saying that it's an opinion channel, not a news channel. There's a fantastic clip somewhere on the internet of Jon Stewart trying to show how, because Fox will tell you, we have opinion shows with Bill O'Reilly, then we have news shows, and they're quite separate. But he, through careful editing of clips, he shows how the opinion side of it is the next day's news.
Yes.
How what Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck, the insane man, will say is the next day being quoted within the news portions of the show as if it's, you know, accepted fact.
Yeah. Or someone's reaction to it, for instance, becomes the next day's news, and in that that way they feed upon themselves.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, it's really valuable satire, that kind of stuff.
And it's also, you know, once again, that the satirist gets away with things the straight commentator can't get away with. And the way they've summed up various things, such as the health debate on both those shows, I just sit there, shake my head. Having lived in America for 10 years, I didn't think the Americans were capable of that. And I think it's more trenchant and more and stronger and tougher than stuff the BBC has done in the past and stuff the ABC's done. They're just brilliant programs.
25 minutes to 12 on The Conversation. Now on 774, ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, the World Wide Web and digital radio as well. If you watch Chaser, do you watch John Safran?
No. He's a serial pest.
So you bear a grudge against him for what
he did
to you?
No, not at all. I just think he's a dope. I don't think he's very funny at all. And I think that, you know, basically crucifying yourself and literally and the things of my experience, I don't find very funny, for example, what he said to me of, you know, where have you been? I've been in Indonesia. We know you're in Indonesia. Do you want to know how I knew? He said.
This is going back to when he pulled a stunt of going through your rubbish bins and trying to get you to come out over the Paxtons. It was a reaction to the way your program had treated the Paxton family.
Absolutely, and which is fair call and a fair cop. But you know, beyond that is ringing the doorbell at the front gate. Beyond that is saying, I've got a package from a current affair for Ray Martin. My wife opens the gate. In he comes up with his Mike Munro mask on and up the stairs, up the driveway. And then ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding to the point on the front door, like for 2 minutes. So that's sort of asinine, childish behaviour, because we didn't open the door. But then to say, so having, you know, lied to get in, but then when I finally stopped to talk to him after I'd basically throttle him. I said, well, okay, fine, let's talk. And so he said, well, you know, why don't you go to work? Why are you at home at 9:30? And I said, oh, I've been...
You're a bludger, like you say, the Paxton.
I'm the bludger. Busy, basically, I'm the bludger. And Paxton was off to... Shane was off to one side. And he said, but I've been in Indonesia for two weeks, I said, working non-stop. And he said, we know. And I said, well... and he said, do you want to know how we know? And I said, yeah, please tell me. And he said, because we implanted a camera in your forehead. And I said, that's about as funny as a toothache. Thanks very much. Goodbye. I couldn't see the comedy now. Maybe too subtle for me. I couldn't grab it. But anyway, that's cool. But it's, you know, I notice ABC is going to run the program again.
Well, they have got the, well, I don't know about this except what I've read in the newspaper today, which says that the pilot, that sketch or stunt, or call it what you like, was part of a pilot for Safran for the ABC, and it's never been shown. Did you have an undertaking?
Yes.
At the time that it wouldn't ever
yes,
go to air?
Absolutely. From the chairman of the ABC and from the CEO, from
Brian Johns, the managing director.
And Donald McDonald, who rang up and apologised and sent my wife a bunch of flowers for the harassment. It was beyond that. It was a desk in the middle of the street outside our house. It was shots of the house. It was our son went to a school across the road from there that my wife tried to explain to Safran about it, that it basically was sort of this carry on out the front. The kids all had the window up at the school across the way, and we'd had a death threat earlier about some drug stories I was doing and around. So it was not the time to actually have your house on camera, etc. And it was all there. So the ABC actually sent us some paper, sent us some flowers, and apologised for this and said, look, you know, we own the.
So it was a verbal undertaking
yes.
from either Donald McDonald or Brian Johns,
both.
From both,
both,
that it wouldn't be shown ever.
Mm. And so it appeared that the ABC owned the pilot, and that's what we were told. And then it suddenly appeared as a still photograph of me throttling him, and then of course it appeared as you know for as a grab on YouTube, and then it appeared on the start of Media Watch for about 3 years.
Congratulations! What you've succeeded in doing is reminding everybody who'd of course perhaps forgotten about it or never even knew about it. There's that two-edged sword of at play, isn't there, in a way?
But it's interesting because in your book, Ray, you talk about the Safran incident and Frontline, and you go into all that impact that had. But it's funny because you talk about the Paxtons. That would, I mean, compared to what they do now on, pardon me, on Today Tonight and The Current Affair, it seems like the Paxton era it was like four corners by comparison. I was watching Today Tonight last week, and this was a
you
story. I was. It's the funniest show on television. last week they were going, okay, horse racing. What's it all about? Can you win at the races? We decided to find out by sending a racing expert, the fiancé of Jeffrey Edelston, and a psychic along to the races. Now, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, you would never have done that. Would have been ludicrous. It's like the funny story at the end of the news about the cat trapped up the tree has become
a lead story.
The guts of it.
The lead story, yes. Interesting. And yet, having said that, there are 3.5 million Australians who watch those 2:30 news nightly programs. So I don't think Australians are idiots. I think they're very sensible. And so there's something there. There's some appeal in those consumer stories. Now, I don't think programs ever succeed in Australia for long if they're dopey. So clearly there's a need for those programs. They're just not current affair. If current affairs programs, if you don't interview the Prime Minister during a federal election, then you're not a current affairs program. And you'd never interview the Leader of the Opposition under those programs at the moment. But there are, you know, if you take capital cities and regions, there are, as I say, 3.5 million people who watch it every night. So clearly there's some appeal.
But you say, like interviewing the Prime Minister, the only way the Prime Minister would be on those shows now is if, you know, is Kevin Rudd sexy? Or they like it when someone has appeared to misuse perks. You know, he's gone overseas on a trip.
Rorts.
And he spent, well,
scandal.
Not even that big, just, you know, $1,000 was spent at the minibar or something like that. I mean, it's incredibly trivial. But you say, as you said earlier, people in Brisbane and Sydney watch Q&A. That's got huge ratings.
As against the footy show.
I'm not saying that the audiences are stupid. It's just that they're being treated as stupider than they are.
And some of the interviews that Tracy's done this year have been as good as any I've ever seen on television. And so she's a fine interviewer, and she gets ratings with those as well. So once again, maybe there aren't the people around, but it would seem to me that by definition you'd say, well, hang on, if this works, let's do more of that rather than more of the latest miracle diet.
Maybe less
psychics, I would suggest.
Oh, no, more psychics, especially on this show too. We haven't had enough of them here either. That's a reference to last week, Ray Martin. I don't expect you to follow up on that at all.
He's gone in hard against the psychic, apparently. There's been some trouble, right?
What about
you and Don Lane?
What about Media Watch? Do you follow Media Watch? Because they did you over a few times.
Yeah, they did, regularly for a while, certainly Stuart Littlemore days. Now, I think it's we all watch, we in the business watch Media Watch. It's got a role to play, but I think that they've been less so now, I think, with the current host, but I think they've been guilty of the same things they accuse others of, you know, in the sense that the period that I can remember, they never bothered to check. The accusations against people were done without any phone calls. At least they make.
Well, I can assure you there's intensive research done. Now, how would you go hosting Media Watch?
Yeah, it'd be fun. It'd be fun. I think it's a good program. And I'm surprised one of the commercial networks didn't do it in the old days. Certainly Channel 9 might have done it, because I think there's enough appeal there for you know, for people who read magazines and newspapers and watch television programs, as all Australians do. So I think it's a very commercial program, but not in its format of the past.
You could kind of marry it together with wacky headlines and silly stories and goof tapes and stuff-ups. Yeah. I mean, it could be entertaining as well as informative if it was better resourced to have a longer show, you know, if it wasn't just 10 minutes.
Hey did a bit of that, didn't they? You know, they used to that Media Watch, they'd come in and have a look at stuff.
But also then you can delve into issues. I mean, I think the greatest thing missing at the moment in Australian media, on TV anyway, is an analysis of what makes the media tick. Mm. And so, you know, Rupert Murdoch, a few weeks ago, James Murdoch gave a speech about the future of journalism in the UK. And that's triggered a complete tit-for-tat battle between ABC, BBC on the one hand, and in particular the Murdoch family empire on the other, about whether or not free-to-air ABC and BBC journalism is undermining the efforts and the future of the internet and the efforts of commercial providers. It's a fascinating debate, but one that you can't kind of dismiss in 30 seconds. You've got to go into detail.
Gerald Stone's book on Who Killed Channel 9 sold over 80,000 copies. That's a massive seller in Australia. You'd think that only journos and maybe Channel 9 people would buy that, and yet clearly it's been wider than that. So there is an interest in radio and television and newspapers way beyond perhaps what we think.
Well, we always got told on commercial radio, don't talk about what's in the paper, because we've done research and 9 out of 10 people don't read the papers. Now, even if that's true, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but let's say it is true. I could never work out why it would therefore follow that people wouldn't want to hear what was in the paper. Mm. I thought that if people weren't reading the papers, they'd actually be more interested in going, oh, I haven't read them. What's this bloke talking about?
We used to get letters constantly when I was doing midday from women who were home having babies or home for whatever reason, especially when they're having babies, and they would write to me saying, we tried to disguise the fact it was a current affairs program, and they'd say, please don't stop the news and current affairs, because I don't get to read the papers anymore. I'm at home doing so-and-so, so I get my news from what you present at midday, obviously when they're feeding the kids sandwiches and so on. So, you know, obviously they don't get to read the newspapers, and they kept up with the world through a program like their radio programs and through midday.
Now, were you on midday? Did you say 10 years? You were
almost, yeah.
Wow,
almost.
That was. Yeah. I remember there were so many things that happened on that show. It was live to air. There was one. Now, I'm not sure if this was when you were hosting or Kerry Ann was hosting. The singing cowboy. Do you remember that guy? Came in on a horse.
Yeah, that was me. That was me. Yeah.
And he was doing Rhinestone Cowboy. And somebody, I think, in the audience, did they take a photo? Did they frighten the horse? And the horse got out of control, but he still kept trying to sing it. And so it sounded like this. It sounded like a Rhinestone Cowboy.
That's right.
As he kept being wrenched around the studio. I think Jeff Harvey may have been possibly in danger of being kicked in the head by a horse.
We actually had. By the time we get to Phoenix and Rhinestone Cowboy, Glenn Campbell. He was live and down the front singing to the audience, and one guitar string went, bing, and he kept going, and another one went, bing, and he sort of looked at me, and I had to say, just go on, there's no... So he did, he sort of played the rest with four strings, and we had Tony Bennett on at the start, and I went across, because he was such a gem, I went across to watch him rehearse with Jeff and an orchestra we had in, and so he said to me, I introduced myself, and he said, now, just tell me, this is live to tape, Ray. And I said, no, this is live, and he sort of mocked a heart attack, and it was live, so Americans and Brits coming out couldn't believe it wasn't live to tape.
Because the Letterman type shows are done in the afternoon because of the time difference between New York.
So to get the F word or the C word, as we did have, on the show, there's nowhere to go.
Who was the most foul-mouthed in 10 years?
usually a comic of some kind, you know.
Right.
Yeah, a comic who'd rehearse beforehand and never use the language, and then come out once he, you know, one of the blokes from an RSL club or
that circuit.
And so I'd get a call from Sam Chisholm, who liked his Shakespearean words as well, and he would say, did you have any idea this bloke was going to say that? And I'd say, no idea at all. And so he was against even, you know, someone saying bloody on it.
Right,
it was
right.
adults' viewing time, so we were allowed to say that, but it was just that, you know, that obviously people get upset by some of the language that was on there, but that's unlike radio, where there's a 7-second delay so often. There was no safety net, so someone actually forgot the words or slipped over or said something. Frank Galbally was the one who said the F word 3 times on their telling us to it,
and he didn't. In context?
Yes, in context, but nevertheless, I mean, I could see the audience collectively draw their breath and collapse before our very eyes.
But no, I mean, there's very few people around for whom that's still a terrible shock.
But we're probably
talking whether it's
80s.
Appropriate or not. Yeah, well, that was totally different.
80s.
But even now, we had someone inadvertently and completely without warning use the F-bomb on this program just a few weeks ago. Well, I think we had 3 phone calls and an email or something.
Yeah.
And
People don't mind if it's the host, people will complain. If it's the guest,
so don't use it again, John.
If it's the guest, I think most people go, you know, it wasn't his fault. What could he have done?
I don't like it. And if I'm sitting on the tram or something and I hear kids swearing, I find it very, very annoying. But at the same time, the reality is it's far more frequently used.
Well, this was one
that used to be.
Very quickly, this is one I mentioned in the book, but it's one where Galbally had his book out, which is a fascinating book about the law. And but he had a story there about at one stage he defended a pet shop owner in Melbourne who had been accused of animal cruelty. And he actually brought into the court, he brought a parrot on a stand. And in the book, he says the parrot said, in the middle of the court case, the parrot said, get effed, get effed, get effed. And it was a very funny story. And I said to Galbally, you know, you've got to tell that story. And he said, I can't use the word. And I said, no, don't use the word. Please don't use the word. Just say, get what's-her-name, get what's-her-name, and everyone will know. And he said, oh, that's right. And he was a man who dealt in words all his life and was impeccable and spoke in 3 or 4 languages. Anyway, so he said, well, I'll tell that story. And it came along, and I said, tell the story about the parrot. And he said, I can't use that word. And I said, yes, of course you can. And the audience said, yes, of course you can. And he did.
So he blamed you.
And then when he said, can we erase that? I said, no, Fred. Too late. And then we got, at the same time, we actually got the executive producer held up a note that said, we have a bomb threat. We need to clear the studio, but don't panic. And so the bomb had just gone off with Frank having said the magic words. And the same, we did, someone had rung up from the painters and dockers or someone, and someone had rung up and threatened to bomb the place. So we had to quietly clear 200 old ladies out of the studio and go on with it.
11 minutes to 12. Ray Martin is our guest in the conversation now today, and Tony Martin is my co-host. How many times have you been sued?
Only lost once. In all the times we've done it, I Angry Anderson was on and made some comments about one of our Olympic officials.
On his soapbox, that would have been.
Yeah, no, he was on the soapbox, and I tried to water it down at the time, but we still got hit, only a small amount, only 10 grand, but it was the only time in life, touch wood, that it's ever happened. Otherwise, I've tended to have been able to cover it, I think.
And what about threats, including Gough Whitlam and Lionel Murphy, when you were back in the ABC?
Yeah, we did a story with James Jesus Anglin, who was the number 2 at the CIA and had been the boss of counterintelligence, and therefore the most powerful man, and totally paranoid like Richard Nixon, and a dangerous man in the 70s. And he gave us this interview for Four Corners, which was about 8 rolls of film, which was about close to 100 minutes, and most extraordinary stuff about the Whitlam government and about their role and the loss of confidence in the Whitlam government. And
by the CIA.
By the CIA, and basically the undermining of the CIA, of the Whitlam government. And so we sent it through. It was just amazing. The cameraman was David Brill, who'd been to Vietnam for a long time, done lots of top stuff for the ABC. And so he was shocked. He kept looking. I kept looking at him, and he turned away from the eyepiece and raised his eyebrows. He couldn't believe what this bloke was saying to us and about his interference in Australia. And so we sent it through to Four Corners, and Whitlam and Murphy both threatened to sue. He talked about Murphy being a bull in the china shop when ASIO raided when the ASIO files were raided down here in Melbourne.
Murphy was a High Court judge by then.
That's right, and he'd been the Attorney General at the time when he raided the files, as he had every right to. But anyway, so on the basis of that, they both threatened to sue, and Four Corners held never ran the story. I filed it. That was a Saturday night, Four Corners, those days. And the next day we had correspondence report on. And I sent the same story through a correspondence report on radio ran the interview. We never heard from Gough or Lionel Murphy at all. Four Corners lost the tape. So those.
Sorry, say it again.
They lost eight rolls of a film.
Do you believe that?
Well, no, I don't believe it because
the ABC is meticulous in its archiving.
And Wendy Borchers is the archivist in Sydney. I know her from my ABC days. She's impeccable. She never loses anything.
So where did they go? From where to where? When did you see them last?
When I put them on a plane and sent them off to Four Corners.
And they got to Sydney?
Oh, yes. They were looked at, and they were actually, you know, the transcript was basically given to Gough and to Lionel Murphy, and they disappeared from the ABC archives, never to be seen again. A friend of mine at Channel 7 back in the early 80s tried to buy them.
They'd be explosive now.
Oh, absolutely. Were extraordinary what they had to say, but they disappeared. But the other tag that I discovered from Wendy as well, that she and Tim Bowden wrote a book, the 50th anniversary, 50 years of ABC television, and the footage of Gough on Parliament, on the steps of Parliament House on the 11th of the 11th, 75, has also disappeared.
The original
is all gone.
Really?
There were several. So that's gone from the ABC archives in Canberra. Wendy went to get it about several months after it happened. And the only footage, so when Gough finally dies, the only footage, as we all do, the only footage that we're able to see from the ABC was the stuff that Norman Gunston shot that day. That's
what
we've got.
Which is amazing, really. It's like seeing a Forrest Gump.
It is.
Digital reenactment. You just go, hang on, he was there. He's standing right there.
But you imagine there were, you know, certainly according to Wendy, two or three cameras, ABC News cameras there for also showing who was in the crowd, apart from Richard Carlton, who was there, as we know, but everyone else in the crowd. So that's gone. Channel 9 disappeared. Channel 7's disappeared. The only footage we had was Channel 10, which was not known for its news coverage at that stage. And that's now what's been circulated to 7 and 9 as well. But there isn't. And Wendy said she rang the tape editor, the news editor in Canberra. In those days there was no security, of course. We just put it on the shelf and said, look, we better have that stuff and we better have it in Sydney because it's important historically. And he went to get it and said, it's gone.
Someone souvenired it somewhere along the way. There's not much in here about some other notorious people who you, I think, were quite close to. René Rivkin barely rates a mention in here, but were you, I think, a character referee for him?
I was. He was on Midday for us for about a year and a half as our sort of shares advisor, and I, in that sense, I wouldn't say I was a friend, but I was certainly acquaintance enough to write a reference for him and, you know, what I knew about him, but didn't
really...
Are
you shocked by what you now know about him?
Yeah, I think so, although he was always a colourful, larger-than-life character. I'm not, and he wanted to dabble in either art or making films, a whole range of things. He was bored with the law. He was a lawyer, bored with life, and was looking for excitement in all directions. So I'm not surprised with what came afterwards.
But there's no mention of any of that in the book. He gets mentioned only once and in passing in a list of people who are quite out of a different context.
I wrote probably twice as much as that, John. So there's a heap of stories there that I think Les Carline said to me, you know, what you do with these is you give them twice as much and they tell you what they want.
Because that's
what they did.
Because what you've got, I suppose, is, I mean, it's not just the stories about showbiz, but you've been right there on the spot for so many important and interesting episodes of, well, particularly Sydney corporate life and philanthropic life, and the circles you've moved in give us an insight into the wielding of power. As much as anything in Australia. And I suppose I was looking for a little more of that in the book rather than, I mean, the showbiz stories are terrific, but I was hoping also to get Ray Martin's take on the nature of power in Australia.
Yeah, I had more, I must say, about prime ministers, having interviewed everyone from Bob Menzies right through. And
so is it the publishers who decided to give that a lower priority?
Yeah, I, a bit like writing, doing a television script for Four Corners or for 60 Minutes, you know, you realise you've got to cut some stuff out, and we jockeyed with part of it. I had the right at the end. I mean, that my contract allowed me to have the final say on words, and so if it was there, if I didn't want it there, it wasn't going to be there. But I also had to, first time I've ever worked with an editor for a book, and she was very good, but she was saying basically this is boring and that's interesting, and we argued about some stuff in there that I insisted went back in.
I guess it's what they think their market is, isn't it?
I think so.
Maybe if you were writing it for a different market.
Yeah, could put some more psychics in here?
Right? That's right.
Well, is there room for a dieting advice?
a few miracle diets, yeah.
And some of those, well, I mean,
the same as presidents. I mean, it'd be nice to say that, you know, that George W. was an absolute, you know, as thick as a brick. It'd be nice to. I would like to have talked about Jimmy Carter a bit longer. He was probably, along with Clinton, the most intelligent of those presidents whom I ever met or interviewed. And I think But that's probably for another book somewhere. I think one of those, my son said to me, who's not especially wise at 19, but he said, you know, you've got to pull your head in and, you know, that's why she's an editor, because she obviously knows such things. And right. So I took her word. I think she was very good. She improved the book. I tried to do it without making it chronological. I tried to make it, a little bit here and a bit there. And she kept saying that, look, you know, if people are going to turn to the next chapter, it needs to be chronological. So I basically went along with that. There are some changes. And, you know, I've got a chapter on Graham Kennedy. I've got a chapter on Jeff Hardy. You've got a chapter on Bradman.
Well, if you're interested in showbiz and stuff, this is an absolute wealth of material. But what's next then? What is the next chapter for Ray Martin?
Obviously, I can only do journalism. That's I'm not a very good banker or real estate salesman. And I love it. I just love it. So I'll go back and I'll tell stories and I'll do some... I'm doing 60-minute stuff at the moment and I'll keep doing that and I'll keep doing some other, you know, television storytelling and maybe ABC.
Here's what I want to see. A town like Dallas reunion. Where are they now? Ross Daniels, Jeff Harvey... Get everybody back together.
Putting the band back together.
It's not so silly when you look at Hey Hey and Don Lane special. There's probably some room for variety out there somewhere. But
were you ever shot out of a cannon, Ray, on midday?
I wasn't. It's still in store.
People of that calibre are hard to find.
That's true.
Richard Stubbs, speaking of men of that calibre.
Indeed.
Thank you very much.
He was a colleague. We did lots of stuff together.
We did. Worked on a midday show, worked on all sorts of things.
Anything you're allowed to tell us?
No.
Right, okay. No. There goes that then.
I'm still waiting for the publisher to get back with the unedited manuscript notes.
Yeah. Just check it all carefully.
That's right.
Interesting, Ray, dealing with being edited, though. It clearly was a traumatic time and experience for you.
Yeah, it was probably... better than I thought. I mean, I found over Four Corners days and 60 Minutes days in with a producer that I'm very proprietorial about my words, that I write everything that I say. And so suddenly when someone says, no, that's pretty boring, or that doesn't work, then you say, hang on, stick it up your jumper.
Maybe like Michael Parkinson, you can do a stage show of the book. Stories of My Life, Ray Martin's autobiography, is published by...
Random House.
It's in the shops now, in time for Christmas. Lots of stories about practically anyone who's been anything in showbiz in Australia, as well as a long career with the ABC, which I think is probably much overlooked. Ray Martin's autobiography, Stories of My Life. This afternoon, Stubbsy.
This afternoon, all sorts of things. Gabby Kennard is celebrating her 20th anniversary of her solo flight around the world, and funnily enough, her hero was Amelia Earhart, and there's a new movie with Hilary Swank, Amelia. See all the links there. We're going to have a chat about that. Brian Negus, no relation, is the General Manager of Public Policy at the RACV. I'm going to continue the conversation we've been having throughout the day, and I suspect we will for some time. What? They're what now? I was riding in and I noticed there's a solid white line on the right-hand side of the cycling lane, which is the left-hand side of where main traffic goes.
Yeah.
So does that mean you can't cross it if you're U-turning? Does that shorten the width of your road as you U-turn now?
It's I think it's snuck up on a lot of us.
And what about taxis? How are they going with their beep, beep, beep,
beep, beep? They don't take any notice of the law anyway.
Ah, excellent. John Fain, direct all complaints to John Fain. Billy Birmingham will come in. Joe Coy, a whole lot of stuff. So road, jokes, flying.
Yeah.
I'll just stay still.
Oh, hardly likely.
Yes.
Richard Stubbs threatening to get together with Ray Martin. Now, that would be something.
That's a nice thing. Get Shane Bourne as well. He was part of the gang.
Yeah.
Seem to remember.
Tony can do some improv.
Get the bloke on the horse again, the singing cowboy.
Yeah.
Ron Casey, is he still with us?
Yeah, I'm sure he's still around.
Enough already. The autobiography, Stories of My Life, Ray by Ray Martin, is in the shops now. And Tony Martin's book, A Nest of Occasionals. Ray Martin will be at Kmart in Southland, at Borders in Chadstone, Collins in Werribee, David Jones in the city. Lots of opportunities for him in store if you're following up some of those as well. Thank you for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
Thanks, John.